You know, I wrote a number of years ago in my book that we were coming to the time when, unfortunately, agencies, district attorneys or prosecutors, whatever, would rather charge an officer and make him prove their innocence than vindicate him in a professional investigation. And unfortunately, I didn't know how accurate that statement was going to be.
Welcome to Courageous Leadership with Travis Yates, where leaders find the insights, advice, and encouragement they need to lead courageously.
I'm honored to have on the show Kevin Davis. Kevin's a veteran of over 39 years in the security and law enforcement field that included corrections, patrol, narcotics, investigations, SWAT team leader, and over 25 years as a use of force instructor, police and private citizen firearms instructor, and expert on police tactics, training, and use of force. He's the author of what I consider to be the Bible on the topic of use of force. He didn't call it that, but it's called The Use of Force Investigations, A Manual for Law Enforcement. And he's also written a book titled Citizen's Guide to Armed Defense. Kevin's trained thousands of law enforcement officers and private citizens in firearms, tactics, and use of force, and he's consulted and trained police, labor unions, investigators, and agencies on the legal aspects of use of force and use of force investigations. He's truly an expert in the field of use of force, and he's consulted as an expert witness on multiple cases across the country, and he was inducted in the 2019 National Law Enforcement Hall of Fame. It's my honor to have Kevin Davis here with us. Kevin, how are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. And that was Hall of Fame, not Hall of Infamy, by the way.
So. Well, you know, says something about Kevin. I want the audience to know this. Kevin did not even put on his website that he's in the Hall of Fame. Now, can you imagine any other Hall of Fame member in any other profession just omitting that from the website? And so that's something we often talk here at Courageous Leadership, of the courageous leaders. You know, at the end of the day, they're very, very humble. And I've known Kevin for many years. He's a very humble, quiet guy, unless you're going against him on a stand, of course, but he's very quiet and humble and kind of unassuming. But man, brother, what a lifetime of achievements. I'm so honored that you're here. Things are going well for you?
Well, yeah, they are. As you know, I retired from full-time law enforcement in April of last year. And my wife says, you retired from full-time law enforcement, but not working full-time, because, you know, my pursuit in the use of force realm has increased tremendously. And, you know, I've been very, very busy this year, which is a double-edged sword, Travis, because number one, business is good, but sadly, number two, almost all my cases are based on a law enforcement officer being charged with criminal violations. And that's the part that cuts the most. And, here we are.
Yeah. And I want to thank you before we get going for your bold and courageous stance on really this entire issue of use of force. I mean, I know it feels weird to say that. Thank you for being courageous, for just telling the truth. But that is the time we're in, is it not?
Oh, it's definitely, unfortunately, the times that we're in. And, I wrote a number of years ago in my book that we were coming to the time when, unfortunately, agencies, district attorneys or prosecutors, whatever, would rather charge an officer and make them prove their innocence than vindicate them in a professional investigation. And unfortunately, I didn't know how accurate that statement was going to be.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've had leaders like yourself through the years to sort of sound a warning call. I know I myself started talking about the recruiting issue years ago, and everyone just ignored me. They thought it was crazy, you know, and here we are. And you were doing the same thing with use of force and how that was leading. We went from seeing an isolated case here or there that looked weird to darn near every day we see one that looks weird. And I will say, I know you talked about you're busier than ever, and I don't want to say I'm glad you're retired, but I'm glad you're a service to the profession. But you didn't wait till retirement to kind of take a bold stance on issues. I mean, you spent a career spanning three decades of being very courageous and doing the right thing. And I want to ask you a couple of questions. I'm very curious to dive into it. This may shock you, Kevin. There's not many folks like you around. That's why we're pushing this courageous leadership as much as we can, because we need more of it. But my first question is, why do you think that was? What's in you to make you kind of go, you know what? I know the whole crowd's going this way, but I'm going to go the other way. Is there, can you dial it into me and let our audience know, what do you think it was?
Wow. I would say completely out of the law enforcement realm, just family and church and religion in terms of being raised with ethics, integrity, and morality, and character. I mean, it meant more to me. And you know, somebody said, and I don't know who this is, can be attributed to in terms of a quote, but they said, you know, in terms of teaching, that the students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Oh, and, yeah. You know, and it's so true. And that informed my entire training career. And then it has gone on. I just one of those people that has always spoken truth to power. And, you know, I took my lumps along the way, but it made for an interesting career. You know? So probably just the way I was raised.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I sound like I was raised very similar to you. I grew up in a family with a mother and father that would just bust my tail if I did turn the wrong way. And I was very much raised in a Christian home with ethics and integrity. That was everything. And I can even remember back in high school, like my friends coming up to me saying, dude, why are you taking this route? Like, just go with us. Or how come you're going against this or that? I mean, I can't really take credit for it, to be honest, Kevin, kind of like you. It was just kind of in me from the beginning. But you said it made for an interesting career. That is not always a comfortable thing to be this courageous individual, courageous leader. Just, do you have any stories to tell us about your career and kind of how that affected you? Because I'm convinced there's more of us out there than we know, but people, unfortunately, are unwilling to go there because of it can be uncomfortable out there in the world and in your job. Kind of tell us about that.
Well, you know, in law enforcement in general, I mean, I butted heads with, unfortunately, with administrators, and not all of them. I don't want to say that. There are some that I would follow through the gates of hell and literally did in my career, you know, and others who felt, for whatever reason, felt threatened by me. And I think you've run into this as well. The more you educate yourself, the more training you get, the more expertise you develop, you tend to ruffle feathers on the test takers. You know, those people that, you know, want to go up. I never wanted to get promoted. So my object was not to educate myself in terms of seeking promotion. I educated myself because that's the way I was raised. In my family were educators, actually. And they constantly were going to courses and constantly seeking out, you know, my dad was just short of his, you know, going for his PhD when he retired from teaching. My brother has a master's degree in teaching. And, you know, so they were always seeking out training and educating themselves. And then as I did that, first of all, to improve my performance on the street, and it did. I mean, seeking out advanced training and learning about use of force saved my bacon innumerable times. And I really believe that training saves lives. So I did that as my goal as a street officer, and that attracted attention. And I sought out because of I was going to be an elementary school teacher, if you can imagine that, you know. I found that I didn't have the patience for it. So I went into law enforcement after I had began working at a rock concert facility. And, you know, I had an uncle that was a retired sergeant from the Marine Corps, was like a second father to me, very much promoted my law enforcement ambitions and everything. And so as I went that way, and as I began training and attending advanced training, that people said, hey, you know, look at KD, he's going to all these courses and everything, how about if we bring him in as an instructor in the basic academy? And I had great supporters in that regard, including chiefs of police. But others in the ranks in upper management felt threatened by me, and they didn't want to be told by a patrolman that, you know, hey, this use of force that they thought was bad was good. Hey, this, you really botched this use of force investigation, et cetera. They felt threatened. And so that manifested, just a short story, is that I was transferred out of the training bureau because I had written in a Fraternal Order of Police newsletter that our current, at that time, what we called a fast tracker program. In other words, we'd bring people in that had basic academies from other agencies or had gone through a basic academy. We would hire them, give them a few weeks training, put them out on the street, and it wasn't working. I mean, the undeniable, it wasn't working. And I said that. The chief of the police at the time, who was a former Phoebe, transferred me out of the training bureau illegally and improperly. And so the FOP came to me and said, hey, let's sue him. This is wrong. And we did, and we won. And I won, in addition to a monetary settlement, I actually got a letter of apology from the chief of police. So who gets that, Travis?
Well, there's not many chiefs that would want to write that. And you know, Dale Stockton wrote a great article on lawofficer.com many years ago called Never Outshine the Master. And he referred to you and a few others. I may or may not have been involved in that article. Some of the things that would occur. And what I've always told people is I never wanted to outshine anybody, Kevin. I just wanted to do what I love to do. I don't want anyone's rank. I don't want anybody's job. I just want to do what I enjoy doing, what I'm passionate about. But not everybody takes it that way. But I really appreciate what you've always done. You know, it's one thing to keep your mouth shut in your career and then get out of your career. And I see people do this and they write all their articles and they attack people. But you have always been on the cutting edge, just telling it the way it is, telling the truth. And if people don't like it, well, they're just going to have to get over it, right? Because we're kind of in this world where we think feelings and emotion outrank the truth. And that's kind of the world you're living in use of force. I mean, you've been doing this a very long time when it comes to use of force, expert witness stuff and training, and you kind of got a really good beat on the climate out there. When did you see this starting to change? You said you kind of called it a long time ago, but at what point did you see this sort of changing pretty drastically to where this is going to become a very common occurrence where legal justified force would become criminal?
Well, somewhere around 2012 is when I started to perceive this. And it was mostly based, and this is, of course, years before Black Lives Matter surfaced, but I had noticed that what I had referred to or come to refer to as the politics of force was impacting the outcome of force investigations. In other words, let's just forget about the facts, the realities as developed by a proper investigation. Let's just go with what we feel. You know, a buddy of mine, and I don't know whether you know Bob Denton, a dear friend of mine PhD said, call it phenomenology. In other words, it's not based on the facts and the totality of the circumstances. It's based on what you feel or your opinion. And that has increased over the years. And as now that we have body-worn cameras and so much video available, now, and although we see officers who are being vindicated by BWC video, we also see the weaponization of that same system or those systems against officers. And a lot of it is by people that don't know, you know, their derriere from a hole in the ground, you know, and it's just sad that, you know, whether there's some talking heads on TV or news or whatever, or a special interest group, that now we are to the point where let's not even wait until the investigation is completed. Let's charge the officer and make them prove their innocence.
Well, and we know that the vast majority of citizens from the general social survey, they don't understand what legal force is. And by the way, why would they? They're not in law enforcement. They haven't had the training.
No, they don't know the case law, right?
And so
that's exactly right.
And then you show them body-worn cameras, and it can be spun by a number of people a certain way. And that's really where leadership comes in. I'm convinced that if leaders would stick to the facts and stick to the truth and tell the correct context, most of the public follows along. In the same breath, when you get emotional and you say a bunch of lies, either straight up lies or by omission, the public, as once again, follows along. And so we've seen cases after cases to where this has occurred. And really, Kevin, what we're talking about here, there's a supply and demand issue. There's this huge demand for bad cops, use of cops that use too much force, cops that are racist. There's this huge demand problem, but the supply is very, very low. You know, I don't think one of us are going to sit here and say that this profession is perfect, because no profession is perfect, but the supply is certainly low, and we are supplying millions of videos a day, and all they can find typically are just videos where they have to take it out of context and make it seem like it is something it is not, which really is a huge applause to the profession that there's no other profession that would film their day all day long, you know? And I would say, what do you have? Well, what they have a lot of times is lies. I mean, the NBA and the Major League Baseball, they're taking vacation days off of lies, right? And then they never apologize afterwards based on some of these incidents. And so when it comes to body-worn cameras, you mentioned the weaponization of that. What should leaders be doing? Because let's just assume they all have them. That's where we're headed to. About 85% have them now. The rest of the profession is going to have them soon. We wear body-worn cameras. We think that it's being done to help us. But as you said, it's actually the politicians and the activists and the groups out there are actually using it to hurt us. What can leaders do up front with body-worn cameras to make sure they're not used in that way?
Well, one of the big problems we did, and this, my opinions or my beliefs were formed by working 3 years in a body-worn camera unit at the end of my career. So I've reviewed thousands of hours of BWC video footage, as well as multiple officer-involved shootings. Oh, and by the way, a former chief of police of mine said to me when I went to the unit, I keep in mind I had worked for over 25 years teaching use of force and defending that agency in civil cases. He said, you know, you're not going to be reviewing use of force on video. And I looked at him and I said, no, I didn't know that. And then the next thing you know, I'm working on every single officer-involved shooting and multiple uses of force, and to the point where he had to give me a letter of commendation for work I had done on an OIS incident, which is kind of funny. But anyhow, the thing is that when you get – the problem – and you know this to be true, Travis. When law enforcement embraces technology, the problem is that they don't look down the road to the ripples that are going to happen. We're looking in the lake for what ripples may occur. And BWC has tremendous ripples. First of all, you have to understand the technology, and we don't. Very few agencies have a unit capable of looking and doing a use of force analysis. They don't have the software. They don't have the education. And so what I did when I went to that unit is put in for training to educate myself on digital video evidence, and had the great opportunity to learn from some of the top dogs in the business, including Andrew Fredericks and Grant Fredericks. And then we got I ordered digital video analysis software called Input Ace and other software. And so I began breaking these things down. And you learn so much about it, but here's with BWC. You don't have the agencies and administrators don't have the staffing or don't have the properly trained people when they get these systems to do proper analysis on use of force incidents. The courts aren't sophisticated in terms of their AV ability to play this stuff. I mean, I've had homicide cases, murder cases, when I worked as an expert for my local county prosecutor's office, where I had to, I was sitting in the witness box I would be asked a question. I would have to go out into the floor of the court, watch the video, and then go back and answer the question, because they didn't have monitors set up where I could see the video. In the grand jury one time on an OIS incident, you know, that I presented, the grand jurors were, I remember like five of or six of them were gathered around a small monitor in the back of the grand jury room watching the video. And then they didn't have a sound bar in the back of the room or any speakers in the back of the room. So when the suspect said clearly on video, something about a gun, they said, we can't hear that, you know? So we weren't sophisticated to and then we could go into storage, we could go into records and everything else, but people latched on to BWCs. They were pushed into these things, not knowing the many, many ripples that would occur in the criminal justice system because of them. And primarily the thing when we're talking about officer involved shooting or serious use of force incidents, they don't have the knowledge base to really analyze the digital video evidence.
Yeah, one of the things I've often talked about, I talk about in my seminars, is if an alien came down to Earth and they went to YouTube to police videos, they would think we're shooting people every second of every day, because that's the only videos you typically see, because we wait. Oh, yes. We wait until an open records request comes in for these videos. Of course, they're not doing open records requests on the videos where we do good things and where we help citizens and we protect people. And so really, I think it's up upon the leaders to give their community context on what they do. I mean, the one avenue, Kevin, where you could sort of see that was live PD. And of course, the activists got that taken off the air because they couldn't let that truth be out. But I think we've done a really poor job of letting our community see this great tool we have and letting them see exactly what we do on a day-to-day basis to give them context, because it's not like Hollywood. It's not like television. It's completely different. And so most people have a very warped reality of what policing is. And I'm curious to know, you know, you're an expert witness and these officers, everybody on every level on a justified legal use of force, they're not leaders. They're cowards. They pass on the buck. They pass on the buck. They go off emotion and it gets to the juries. And what I have seen, not every time, what I have seen typically is these juries are the first line of defense that actually do the right thing. When they hear the evidence, when they hear the facts, when they hear the context, when they hear what the law says, and they hear from someone like you that can explain that to them, they kind of go, oh, what are we doing here? Explain that to me, that feeling where you're sitting there watching everybody from the prosecutor to the police chiefs and the sheriffs and the people in the community and the activist groups just lying and just saying crazy stuff. And then it gets all the way to the end to a jury. And then they go, yeah, we get this. Kind of tell us your thoughts on that. Do you believe that if we would tell the community those things up front, it would mitigate much of the things that occur through the course of these cases?
Oh, you're spot on. You know, and by the way, recommendation to the audience, if they don't have your book, I highly recommend it, because part of being that courageous police leader is to get out in front of this stuff and to explain to the public, you know, the legal standards of use of force, as well as how law enforcement is trained and everything. We don't do that. You know, we're so reactive in law enforcement. So what you have is, I mean, I don't know whether the audience realizes the sophisticated nature of an attorney like Benjamin Crump and the people that he brings in to bear against law enforcement when he takes a case. For instance, they have social media experts. They have media relations experts that go out there, and they know how to get their version of the story out in front of the public and in the media long before law enforcement. You know, one of the I would highly recommend a book by Melissa Agnes.
Yeah, Crisis Communication, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Excellent book. Yeah. You know, because she, you know, instead of being reactive, to get ahead of the story and to put your version out. But Travis, one time I had an OIS. It was a cross-racial shooting of a unarmed black male by white officers. And I told the bosses where I worked, I said, listen, we need to get ahead of this thing. We need to do a preemptive video release, but I will create a video with context. I will break it down. I will show frame by frame what the subject did. And, you know, it was like arm twisting. At one point, I looked at my office and my former partner laughed because I had the mayor, his chief of staff, his media expert, the chief of police, two deputy chiefs of police, a captain, a lieutenant, and the city safety force director, all in my office as I broke that shooting down for them frame by frame. And it was took so much arm twisting to get them to do it. And you know what? I'm gonna say this: not one complaint, except the media who said that we didn't release the raw video, which was what they wanted. And we didn't get sued. We haven't been sued on the case, and there was no uprising by the public.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I have exactly the same stories. I have stories to where I was able to arm twist and get the video out, and we took a very volatile situation and it went calm almost immediately. And then I have other situations where they wouldn't do it and things blew up, right? And so it's amazing in 2023 we still have leaders that refuse to do that. And I don't even know what to say to it, because you're not lying. You're just putting the truth out there with context, because in law enforcement, everything's context. But these things occur, Kevin. These tragic events are going to occur. As long as human beings are operating in this world, they have always occurred. They will always occur. We have homeowners that tragically shoot and kill their sons or daughters because they thought they were burglars, right? We have these horrible things that occur. And that doesn't make them criminal, because crimes need intent. And I think where we make a mistake from a leadership standpoint is we sit back and we judge these events and we throw shade at it. And then we think it's not going to happen to us. And you and I both know that many of these events we're talking about, or we could talk about, are happening in cities you didn't know about before it happened. Right. And so I think it makes sense for leaders to prepare for these events before they occur. You pray to God they don't occur, but if they do occur, you have to be prepared for that. Versus what we've seen now, where they come out and make wildly emotional statements that have no truth or facts behind it, that just gets everybody in a tizzy, right? And so do you have any suggestions now in a police chief or sheriff or upper management listening right now, where they're in a city and everything's peaceful and calm and this has not happened to them? Are there some things they can do now to sort of help when that occurs? And we hope it doesn't occur, but we work in a business that these things unfortunately do occur. They don't occur very often, and it's really amazing the millions and millions of contacts we make a year. We can name them all on one hand what's happened in recent years, right? So it doesn't occur very often. But what could our leaders do now in anticipation if that was to occur?
Well, just some pre-planning, Travis. You know that the failure to plan is planning to fail. And here you have these circumstances. First of all, let's start at the basics. Train your people the utmost of your ability, including confrontation simulation training. You know, revisit your policy and procedure. Make sure it's up to date. Make sure it's realistic. And make sure that it's not a 30-page thing on what officers can't do, but a short declarative policy on what they can do and the standards that they're going to be held accountable to. Next is train people. Train your officers on use of force, like I said, and actually put them in scenario-based training so they get that, you know, that inoculation effect from good, solid training. Train your supervisors to conduct proper investigations. Train internal affairs and command staff, who, by the way, unfortunately try too hard to get out of in-service training instead of just going and learning. They spend more time trying to get out of it, but actually go and learn what the troops are doing, and then create the structures, including, you know, people that can deal with digital video evidence, your police information officers that are properly trained that can actually communicate to the public and, you know, can actually say a sentence without stumbling. You know, that are savvy people that understand this stuff, including use of force. Because let's be honest, Travis, the number one thing in law enforcement under the microscope right now is the use of force, specifically the use of deadly force. And yet we sit around, twiddle our thumbs until an incident happens, and then we, you know, have this strategy where we circle the wagons and say, what should we do now? Do that advanced planning, do that advanced training, get the structures in place so that when one of these incidents happens, you're not reactive you're actually putting into effect the plans that you made prior.
Yeah, what you just mentioned is a very strong principle in courageous leadership we often talk about called leave no doubt. Like you should build your police department around that if anybody was to attack any aspect of it, that if they tried to attack it, that they would look foolish because you've left no doubt that you have one of the best police departments around. And that is in all the areas you just talked about, training, policy, procedures, all that stuff. But we just don't see that, right? Like you said, we wait until bad things happen. And then you're in a bad position then because then a lot of other people are going to tell you what to change. And they don't exactly tell you what to change based on the mission of law enforcement. And that's kind of where we are right now. And as I talk about that, let's talk about the attack on Graham v. Connor. And we'll have to come back later and really dive deep into that. But that's a 1989 Supreme Court case that dictates use of force in law enforcement. And it's not going anywhere, right? I mean, the last couple of times this case has gone all the way to the Supreme Court, it's been like either a shutout or a 6-3. I think 6-3 was almost the closest it's ever come. The judges, despite political differences on each side of the aisle, are all kind of on the same page that law enforcement needs these protections in Graham v. Connor, meaning you have to judge police officers based on what they know at the time without 20/20 hindsight and what is reasonable based on all that. And of course, it goes into further detail than that. But because this case is not going anywhere, we're actually seeing police agencies, law enforcement groups that are supposed to be supporting law enforcement, states coming out and mandating policies that go completely against this. One of the most popular ones that I'm seeing today is this, you know, last resort policy. And that's pretty dangerous because they're judging last resort based on what they know after the fact. And kind of tell me that to me seems to be the trend moving forward. And there's only one goal in mind by doing that, throw policemen in jail. And so I'm curious to know your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, it's sad that, as you mentioned, some states have come out with California being one, I think in Washington State being another, and Virginia, a case I'm working on right now in Virginia, they changed and restricted the use of deadly force more than Graham allows. And the problem is let me pose this. What about the leadership or lack of leadership with the law in your state changes? It's more restrictive than Graham, yet you don't modify your policy and procedure, and you don't give your troops any training on the new legal standards. What about the vacuum of leadership there? You know, and yet that's exactly what's happened in a couple of cases I've worked in these states where, you know, the AG's office, even they said that before the end of last year in Washington State, that everybody needed to embrace these new legal standards on the use of force. And yet they didn't put out from the state AG that I know of a lesson plan or mandated training. Virginia did the same thing. I even sent an email on a case I worked in Virginia, or after I worked a case in Virginia, I said, hey, did you ever put out a lesson plan to the state law enforcement agencies requiring training? And no answer. And the truth is they didn't. So left to their own devices, these patrol officers in Virginia, the ones that I dealt with, had to go out on their own and find out what the new legal standards were. You know, so here we have, if you're going to change something, then you better have training that deals with it.
It absolutely, Kevin, you would not find this in any other profession on the planet. There is no way that doctors or accountants or exterminators would have some major change to their job and they're not provided the tools and resources to effectively make that change. And the only thing in my mind why they're doing this, is they want cops in jail. There's no other question for me. They're setting the profession up for failure.
Well, I can't, under these circumstances, here's my take on it. Under these circumstances, you're absolutely right. There is no other possible reason. However, what's good for me as an expert witness working in defense of law enforcement officers is that when I go in and work these cases, I find universally that people are not trained in Graham v. Connor. They're not trained in the legal standards from their state. They're not even trained in use of force investigations. They do sloppy, incomplete investigations. they have investigator bias. They operate when watching a BWC video that if it looks bad, it is bad. That a use of force that say for instance is bad equals, as you said, criminal intent. They say that if you have a difference of opinion in officer statements in the incident, that means they're lying. That if an officer makes a statement that's different than the video, that he's lying. I mean, these are all the things that I use when I go in and work a case. And I'm proudly saying that I had only one officer convicted last year, and that was an amazing thing that's subject to appeal. And that was on a misdemeanor case. And complete judge bias, by the way, that's what will be pointed out. Threatened to arrest the defense attorney, by the way, and threatened to charge her with contempt. And then I had one, where we had a hung jury. But other than that, I'm not bragging. I'm just saying that if you go in and you know your business, first of all, if you know your business, this is never going to happen. You know, what's going to happen is that these officers, by and large, will be vindicated in a professional and proper investigation. That's what should be happening. You know, the fact that they are being charged then with crimes, gives people like me the opportunity to come and say, you know what, that's not the law.
Let's talk about the ramifications of that, Kevin. I mean, we don't ever talk about, it's great these officers are vindicated, but it shouldn't even come to that. Like you said, it should be based on an investigation beforehand, like any other criminal. You're looking into a criminal act, you investigate it first. And like I said, other than police officers, no one would ever be able to get away with treating people like this. But, we're dealing with that. But what happens to the mindset of a police officer that goes through this? Maybe they're suspended or terminated from their job. They go through an entire court process. They may think they may lose 20, 30 years of their life behind bars. And then they're acquitted, they're vindicated. But what happens after that? I mean, their lives are never the same. I have to assume their lives are never the same.
Oh, it's horrible. And by the way, if those listeners who are attending the ILEADA conference or on the fence about going, make sure you go, because there's some great classes. But I'll be presenting on officers charged this year. In other words, what are the ramifications to officers? What are the ramifications to agencies? And what can officers do to help mitigate that, prior? How they should plan and prepare for that eventuality. But yes, I think that when you're talking about these types of incidents, changing law enforcement, because officers are perceptive as to way how people are being treated. And if you treat an officer like this, what's going to happen is morale is going to be adversely impacted. The best recruitment tool, and you know this to be true, is to take care of the people that already work for you. They're your best recruiters right there. But if you don't take care of the people, if you throw them under the bus to serve political gods, then what's going to happen is word's going to get out. And pretty soon, you're going to have a hard time recruiting officers. Proactive policing is going to go down. They're going to sit. And this has happened in my agency, my former agency, where officers sit in parking lots and wait for calls rather than go out and do proactive policing, because it's doubtful that they're going to be supported by the agency. My former agency, the city, is now looking at the Citizen Review Board. They already have a police auditor who's a complete waste of taxpayer money and time, and now they're going to a Citizen Review Board, which is even worse. Why? Because there's an actual problem? No, because of politics. And officers are sitting back and saying, I'm not doing this, brother,
Yeah, and what the amazing thing about all these so-called reforms is they have no good reason to do the reforms. Then once the reforms are implemented, there's nobody that comes behind them and they go, well, did this work? I mean, use of force policy is a prime example, Kevin. We're shooting people at a higher rate now than we were in 2015 because violence has increased in this country. It hasn't ticked up too much, but it has ticked up a little bit. And meanwhile, we've changed all these use of force policies and all this training check the box stuff that we thought would do this. And it has no difference at all, because they're reforming the wrong group of people, which is law enforcement. They ought to be reforming the violent criminals that keep attacking law enforcement. You know, I have no respect for the LeBron James of the world, because he has a huge platform where all he has to say to help with this issue is, hey, here's an idea. Don't fight cops. Don't attack cops. He could say that to people, you know.
Well,
and
you know, he's from my hometown, so I'm not going to stick up for him in his anti-law enforcement.
Well, it's just silly. You know, it's just silly that and I'm convinced that maybe they don't want the problem to go away. So they keep the rhetoric going so they have something to talk about, because I really think it would make a difference if somebody of stature, a president, an athlete, somebody, instead of just throwing gasoline on the emotion, they would go, here's an idea. You know, the courts is where you fight what's happened to you. You don't fight it on the streets. And because we could end use of force tomorrow if everybody complied, right? And that's not happening. No one's telling them to do that. They're almost feeling bold. And so it's really, really crazy. I want to ask you one more thing, Kevin, and you just led into it. You talked about no proactivity. And by the way, I kind of laugh when all these police departments are running around and wondering why they can't recruit, and are throwing all this money at it, and the signing bonuses and all this stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, are you serious? You really don't see why you can't recruit. Look in the mirror. Look what you've done to people. You cannot make a job impossible and expect anyone to raise their hand or do that job, Kevin. So that issue is not going away. I can tell you that right now, until we change from the inside. And one more question. You talked about the proactivity, but what about from an officer safety standpoint? I know, just like me, you have seen multiple videos where officers have let people point guns at them, do things to them, and they are not responding to that. How much of that you think has been a chilling effect based on them being scared of a prosecutor or being scared of YouTube more than someone with a gun?
Well, unfortunately, Travis, as you and I talked before we went on the air, it's not just the outsiders, it's not just the activist groups, BLM, or the politicians that are going after law enforcement. It's our own profession. You know, I dealt with this today in a case in which, I mentioned a tasering in Minnesota, where a law enforcement veteran said, this is unbelievable, and yada, 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 that this tasering, and how many people have been killed with tasers, and this guy was just lumbering along, fleeing in an auto accident. Well, that's not the truth. He hadn't even watched the entire tape. The entire tape showed this guy after the auto accident tried to get in several different cars, whether you call it carjacking or not, along the highway, and he was running away from officers. By the way, two female officers who responded and tasered him, neutralized the threat, and controlled him. And this so-called expert didn't even know that of this thing called disparity of force, which certainly we allow our female officers to use more force against male subjects than male officers do. It's been a long thing. We want them to use those remote controls because we understand that they get in trouble when they go in and try to wrestle with male suspects. But yet here we are eating our own, or in this individual, you know, condemning the use of force before he knew the full context of the video, before he, had educated himself about the totality of the circumstance. So we can't just blame, you know, outsiders. We're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And oftentimes in the guise of, you know, ego. In other words, I believe that I would have done better than this had I been in those same circumstances. And that's not how it's supposed to be judged. The question is, would a reasonably prudent and well-trained officer in the exact same circumstances have used that amount of force? That's the legal question. You know, not whether they could have done this or should have done that, or maybe their tactics, if they were different, the incident would have never happened. But here we are throwing our own people under the bus. You know, so yes, of course they're, trepidatious and hesitant to use force. My God, can you blame them?
Right. And Kevin, I'll tell you, this has been epic, man. Before we get off here, how can people reach you?
Well, the best way is through email at trainer, that's TRAINER, Kevin Davis, no hyphens or periods, trainerkevindavis@gmail.com. Or you can send me an email through my link at katie KevinDavisForceTraining.com. I'm on the web. Just do a Google search and my website will come up. I do publish, I try to get out every couple of weeks a blog about these topics. And like you said, I'm not hesitant to go out on the thin ice and tap around a little bit because that's what we need right now. We don't need to be conservative in our views about training and about use of force. We need to really prepare and train our troops so they survive the encounter and they survive the internal investigation, they survive the media scrutiny, and they survive the you know, potential civil liability as well.
Well, I can't agree with you more, Kevin. I'm so thankful that you were here. I'm honored to have you. And on behalf of the entire law enforcement profession, thank you for your dedication and efforts on these issues. There are many officers that have their freedom today because of you, and I can't thank you enough for that. Thank you for listening, and remember, lead on and stay courageous.
Thank you for listening to Courageous Leadership with Travis Yates. We invite you to join other courageous leaders at travisyates.org.